Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamarais.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Marais, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing two new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week. All right, let's dive into our first query letter. Dear Ms. Marais, Ms. Waters, and Ms. Lira, The Roof Above is the story of a young woman's journey to find love, independence, and belonging, though not necessarily in that order. It's women's fiction, 100,000 words, single POV, and set during the early years of the War on Terror, 2001 to 2006. Kelly McGowan, from a dysfunctional family in New Hampshire, realizes her relationship with her fiancé Matt has changed after something happened between his West Point graduation and their arrival at his first army assignment in Georgia. When Matt returns from a deployment, he finally reveals a secret he's hidden from her. Kelly, devastated, leaves him. The only place she has to go is her aunt's house on Florida's panhandle, where she's walloped with another whammy, a catastrophic hurricane decimating the town. Kelly goes on a quest to build her own foundation for the future, regaining her independence and reopening the door to love, to find the kind of contentment that only comes with being where you truly belong. The Roof Above parallels W.E.B. Griffin's The Lieutenants, but from the spouse's point of view in today's army of back-to-back deployments. Siobhan Fallon's You Know When the Men Are Gone and Laura Trentham's The Military Wife tell similar stories in different genres, literary fiction and romance, respectively. An army veteran and retired army spouse, I'm also the mother of two active duty army officers who've been deployed 5 times in the past 8 years and who have 5 children under the age of 6. I admire and am humbled by the strength of these families who've inspired me to tell the story. I published a memoir about my experiences in the second class of women at West Point, Tough as Nails, One Woman's Journey Through West Point. I've written technical proposals, numerous articles for local publications, and a humor column for a community magazine. I live full-time in Mexico Beach, Florida, a tiny town that was decimated by a Category 5 hurricane in 2018. Thank you for your time, consideration, and feedback, Gail. Cece, would you like to dive into your take on the query letter?
Sure. I really enjoyed the query letter. Thought it was very well written. If I had to give this person notes, suggest condensing paragraphs 2 and 3. I'm wondering whether we need paragraph 2, only because, like, I love hearing that, you know, something has changed between his West Point graduation and their arrival at his first army assignment. Like, something has changed intrigues me. It's a good way to pique my curiosity. But given that she goes through the plot points in the other paragraph, I don't know if we need that, or maybe we could condense it into one sentence. But that would be my only note. It's a very well-written query letter.
Wonderful. Carly, what did you think?
I thought this was really interesting women's fiction novel. I mean, I think that we have clearly something going on that has another layer to it with women's fiction. You know, it's obviously about the women's journey, but I think there's a nice kind of like the army hook is different and unique to this one. So just kind of starting at the top, we have, you know, a young woman's journey to find love, independence, and belonging, though not necessarily in that order. It's women's fiction, 100,000 words. So I was kind of thinking, like, I don't know if we need the journey to love, independence, belonging, though not necessarily in that order, because to me, women's fiction inherently covers a lot of those things. Like, that's kind of built into the women's fiction category or genre, if you will. So I thought, you know, we could have just, you know, skip the words and just roof above is the story, or is women's fiction. 100,000 words, single POV. And I thought the War on Terror was great. I actually kind of liked that there was the specifics, you know, 2001 to 2006. It's kind of hard to believe that that's considered like a historical time period now, but it obviously is and it needs its own reference point. 100,000 words is a little bit on the long side. So if there are ways to kind of cut this down to 90, that would be a much more attractive word count for many reasons, keeping the reader entertained, you know, translation, things like that. Like that word count is pretty high for this category, I would say, especially because we're not doing any world building because it's contemporary. In the next section, I really wanted to know what the change was and what the secret was. You know, I understand why this person didn't want to tell us that, the sense of leaving it up to us to, you know, request the material, get the material, then figure it out for ourselves. But for me, at the point that I'm looking at the query, requesting it, and then reading your manuscript is sometimes days, weeks, or months apart. So the query's job is to hook us, and the query's job is to get us to request more. And I felt like that left a little bit personally to be discovered, but I understand why this person did it. I would just say for my taste, I would prefer that to know what's going on, because for me, it builds up the whole, you know, the stakes of the whole book. You know, in order for us to fall for her as a character, we need to know what the husband did. Because for women's fiction, you know, again, we have to not necessarily have to be a likable character, but we have to understand, you know, where this entry point into meeting this character is. So I just had a lot of questions about, like, what are the stakes for her story? You know, what are the stakes for her finding her footing again? Are the stakes just, you know, getting her life back on track? You know, there was just so much that I didn't know, just left a lot to be discovered for me. And I just thought we could have just gone one layer deeper here for the sake of hooking the agent. Overall, I really like the title. I think The Roof Above is a great title. I really liked that. And then for the author bio paragraph, I would have wanted to know where you published the memoir. Yeah, I just didn't know if it was self-published or traditionally published, and all of that is kind of a track record that means something. So seems very interesting. I just wanted a little bit more to hook an agent.
Wonderful. Cece, what did you think of those opening pages?
For the listener, we follow the protagonist and two other women as they are preparing to evacuate, and actually evacuating because a hurricane is coming. I'll share a little bit about what was working for me. So on the second page, there's a mention where the protagonist is referring to the character of Amy, right? Like Amy says, "Oh, me too. I can't tell you how much I needed to sit on the beach and catch up." And then the protagonist remarks that her voice seemed lighter, less tired, more content than it had 9 months since that dark day the chaplain knocked on her front door. So that's intriguing, right? Like weaving in these sorts of clues and mentions of what happened, like that dark day, that intrigues me. And there's quite a few moments where the author does that, and that's working really well. It made me want to know what had happened, and that's important. As a small note, I would say there's a few moments where the dialogue isn't in quotations. It's usually when Aunt Patty is talking to the meteorologist on TV. And I would just say include quotation marks. I think it helps, even though it's not proper dialogue in the sense that she's not actually talking to somebody who could talk back. It just helps with readability. This happens a few times. And as a big note, and this would be like the meaningful note that I would share with this writer, what is going on in these pages? Like I said, they're evacuating because a hurricane is coming. It might seem like that's a good place to start a story since a hurricane is undeniably a major occurrence. But right now for me, it's not working because these women have it all together, right? Like they have a great handle on the situation. They're doing a good job of evacuating, and I'm happy for them because it means they're safe. But in terms of fiction, it doesn't quite build to an ideal setup. I would want the setup to be full of tension and full of imbalance and full of conflict. Like I said, I was curious about what had happened in their lives, but I wasn't curious about what was going to happen. And that curiosity of what is still to come is essential in the first pages because that's what keeps us turning the pages. So yeah, I felt that that could be woven into the story a little bit more. The result of this lack of tension is two things. One, it's reading as detached, almost like the protagonist isn't quite caring about what's happening. because again, there's no anticipation. And two, so at the end, we find out that the town of Seabury has been decimated. Like there's no Seabury anymore. A person says it's gone, the town. And what I would say to that is that I don't mean this to sound insensitive, but I don't care that Seabury is gone because I didn't get to see Seabury. So perhaps it would make sense for us to see a little bit of Seabury before, or for the importance of the town to be woven into a way that would make me care about the loss. It's always tricky because you always want to start with momentum and you want to start with action, but you also want to set up enough backstory that people understand the meaning of something like a town dying. But yeah, it's definitely a tricky, challenging thing, but that's what I think needs to happen here.
Great. Carly?
That was great, Cece. I have to add a few things. I felt like the query letter seemed to have a huge emphasis on the army element and the war. And so I was going into these pages thinking we were going to get plunked there, not into the hurricane scene. So when they were talking about, you know, in the opening paragraph says, we didn't dare change the channel. For the past 24 hours, we'd watched swooping arrows, reds and greens and yellows shifting across the radar map. Every track, a possibility, every possibility, a disaster zone. I thought we were in a war zone. I didn't know that we were in Florida. So I just kind of started off confused personally. And then the meteorologist, like, I thought that was a joke. Like, I was, again, this could just be my take and my read. I was out to lunch personally on where we were in terms of the setting. So it took me a long time to wrap my head. I had to read this three times to like, where are we? Where are we placing me as the reader? So really simple things like, you know, the timestamp is October 2005. Even if you just said dash Florida or something like, or dash Seabury, like just something to just ground me in place. I really could have used that. So after that, I was very confused on the characters. So I just came to this one super confused. I didn't know who Amy was. At first, I thought that the speaker was Amy at one point because there's the first person, I believe. So nobody ever addresses the speaker. And so at one point I thought Amy was the narrator. So again, I just personally confused on this one, but again, this could just be one agent, one take, one read. So just take that with a grain of salt. I would have liked to know, you know, yeah, exactly what the setup was. Like Cece said, you know, what's going on here that is unique about this situation. I also thought I wanted to know where they were packing for, because they were so organized. It seemed like we packed the car the night before, like we're ready to go in the morning. And then it kind of just, they seemed like they didn't know where they were going. And obviously if it's because the storm is changing and they might have to change their path and direction of where they want to go, also totally fine. But yeah, just kind of some layers of tension kind of needed to build there for me to really feel like I was connecting with that. I just wanted to highlight a paragraph I really, really liked. I thought the wording was really beautiful here. It says, Aunt Patty's house, like many houses close to the beach in Seabury, was built on stilts. I put the box in the back seat of my car and stood looking under the house, remembering hiding there when I was a kid in the dark of night, listening to my aunt and father talk above me on the deck. In hindsight, I probably shouldn't have done that. Overhearing some of those conversations may have messed me up for life. Too late now. That was just a really great paragraph. I really liked that one. I highlighted that one because I thought it was great. Other than that, you know, there were some details where I feel like we could have even just changed the order of this opening section, because later on we find out, you know, what they were packing in the car, you know, why the aunt, you know, sold the studio and all of this sort of stuff. So I just think we got to fix the order of like how we're meeting the characters, being really clear about everyone's relation to each other, figure out the tension going on with the storm. Like all of these puzzle pieces are hovering to me kind of in orbit of each other. I just would have really liked to just get a really clear sense of the
story. Great. Yeah. And often the case is it's all there. It's like you say, Carly, it's puzzle pieces. It's just figuring out where to slot them, in what order to place them. So it's, you know, these kinds of things are not even always huge rewrites. It's just really realigning something. That's all. Great. So Carly, let's move on to the second query letter. Will you read that for us?
Dear Ms. Waters and Ms. Lyra, I'm pleased to query you with Title A, 77,000 words, a book club ready literary thriller that will appeal to fans of Leanne Moriarty's Big Little Lies and of Robin Harding's The Party. Set in a Tony tight-knit Atlanta neighborhood known for well-funded schools and hyper-involved parents, Title A is the story of secrets kept between parents and children and husbands and wives and the ultimate price of loyalty. Everyone who's anyone knows Lori, a former corporate lawyer whose career took a backseat to her husband's. Her resume now lists things she neither expected nor desired: stay-at-home mom, PTA maven, and social hub of her community. Thankfully, Lori has her best friend Eden to keep her sane. They met as newcomers to the neighborhood and leaned on each other as they navigated the unspoken rules of playground politics and competitive motherhood. Over a decade later, they've become the life force of the community and of each other. Eden draws Lori out of her shell and reminds her that there is life beyond her to-do list. Lori reins in Eden's fiery personality and defends her when Eden's irreverent streak causes trouble. Lori's life charts a predictable course until the day her teenage son and golden child is accused of rape. In a nightmarish twist, the accuser is Eden's teenage daughter. After the rape accusation, the neighborhood chooses sides. Lori is torn between clearing her family's name or salvaging her one true friendship. As Lori struggles to reconcile the truth about her son, Eden must decide whether to confront her own long-buried secret in order to keep history from repeating itself with her daughter. The two friends are about to find out just how far they'll go to protect their families and at what cost. About me, after growing up on a small town dairy farm, I spent 15 years soaking up the neon lights of New York City. I now live in Atlanta, where I write essays on various topics concerning motherhood for outlets like the Huffington Post, Scary Mommy, and The Every Mom. This work inspired me to write a novel that addresses the ultimate parenting question, how far we'll go to protect our children. Title A is my debut novel. I chose to submit this novel for your consideration because I see you're looking for smart book club fiction with emotional, well-paced narratives, which my book has. Also, in a bit of a fangirl moment, I've loved listening to both of your interviews and your new Books with Hook segment on Bianca's podcast, and I rarely stalk both of you on social media for your great insights on the publishing industry. Thank you for taking the time to consider representing my work. I look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, author.
Wonderful. So, Carly, would you like to immediately dive into your insights on that?
Absolutely. This is, you know, my bread and butter in terms of what I'm interested in. So, you know, you had me with so much going on here. I did want to mention something about comp titles. I feel like we talk about comp titles every week, but we could endlessly talk about comp titles. I feel like Leah Moriarty's Big Little Lies is a tough comp. You know, it's kind of a brand name now. It's bigger than the book. It's a TV show. It becomes a signpost for so much more than the book itself. And when a debut author is using a comp, it's best if it is a book comp in a way that's not a brand. I just felt like it's not actually telling us enough other than, yeah, this is a brand, big brand name book. Tons of people comp this, you know, it's not unique. So, you know, I just felt like we probably could have found a better comp. You know, one that stood out to that stood out to me that I wanted to mention that might be great comps are Zoe Whittle's Best Kind of People and my clients, Tracy and Wendy. They wrote a book called Girls with Bright Futures. They were actually guests on Bianca's podcast. They're wonderful. And they also have a book in this space. So I just think there are other options other than Big Little Lies.
I feel safe
almost as a comp, but also simultaneously not telling us very much. So that's my two cents on that. Keep it if you want to. Totally fine. That's just kind of what goes through my head when I see a comp like that. I also wanted to comment on the next paragraph, which was feeling a bit synopsis to me. The author used a kind of traditional synopsis tactic where they capitalize authors or the characters' names in the query letter, which is more of a synopsis thing. So I would just say don't capitalize characters' names in a query letter. I also felt like the first paragraph, like the first body paragraph here, you know, didn't really have any drama in it. It was really setting up, you know, the characters, the relationships to each other, you know, a mom, you know, not pursuing her, you know, her dreams and kind of stuck in a PTA role. To me, this is very background surface. We really need a hook. And especially if you're using a comp like Big Little Lies, what is the hook, right? Like right away, we want to know, does this fit neatly into that Big Little Lies world? If so, there's a lot of books out there like this. So what is the hook that is equal to Big Little Lies, right? Because you don't want to say, oh, my book is under the Big Little Lies umbrella. You want to say my book is as good as Big Little Lies. So where's this giant hook? And then we find it in the next paragraph, right? It's this, the accusation of rape, you know, kind of dismantling this friendship in this community. So now we're getting somewhere, right? To me, this is much more meaty, very dramatic. And so the rest of the query letter really flows from there. So I would just rethink that opening, that second paragraph, which was the entry level to the plot, because I understand in a multi-POV novel why authors feel like they have to do this, right? They have to set up the two voices. But I always say, you know, when we have a multi-POV or dual POV book, the query letter has to bring the story together, right? Like what is the purpose of this book as a whole, not necessarily telling us two plot lines. So ultimately, this is a very interesting book, and I'm being, you know, heavy in my critique because I think it's really great. And I think it has the potential to go really far. So most of my notes are great, 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 great in the margins. So well done.
Great. Thanks, Carly. Cece, what was your take on it?
Yeah, I was nodding along as Carly spoke, because for me, the writer could actually remove the second paragraph altogether and replace it with one sentence that establishes that they've been friends for a decade and that, I guess you could keep the navigated the unspoken rules of playground politics and competitive motherhood, because that's a good line. But really, it could be one line. A whole paragraph can be condensed into one line because, like Carly said, the hook is what matters and the hook is there. It's clearly present and it makes me curious to know. I actually remember when I was reading this for the first time, I was like, okay, so I love that the author knows what drew Lori to Eden and vice versa. I love that the author knows that the corporate lawyer background took a back seat and that affected Lori's personality. This is interesting. These are things you should know about your main characters, but you don't need to put them in the query letter. So what I would tell the writer is, great job knowing all these things. It shows that you've done a character study, and that's essential in writing good fiction. But again, keep it out of the query letter. And then other than that, it's like, great. It would absolutely, like, if I got this, I would absolutely be requesting pages, because it's a great hook and it makes me curious and I want to know what happened.
Okay, Carly, what did you think of the actual pages?
So right away, we jump into Lori's point of view. My first note was that, you know, we only have Lori's point of view. So, you know, I made a note just to mention how important it is when you're writing a dual POV or multi POV novel to make sure the voices are extremely distinct. So we didn't actually get a chance to read Eden because this is, you know, just a short sample. So just, you know, emphasis to everybody out there how important it is to make sure these are very distinct voices. I was a little bit nervous because these are two PTA moms of a certain community. I just really wanted to emphasize how important it is to make sure every character has a very distinct voice. The next thing I wanted to mention was swearing. You know, I think we talked about this before. I'm all for swearing. I think it's fine. I think it's a normal human, you know, reaction to things. I did want to note that some readers will be put off by swearing. So just, you know, take that with a grain of salt. I leave that with you, the author, to make that decision. But, you know, there was a number of shits and fucks. So, you know, just take that with a grain of salt. That might not be for everybody. And that's your decision to make as the author. Some of my notes in here were just, I really wanted to get a little bit more into Lori's head in terms of how she felt about being put in this situation. So the situation she's in is there's some sort of fundraising event and they hired an Elvis impersonator and the Elvis impersonator's drunk. And so the organizers, the PTA moms, are trying to rally to figure out how to fix this scenario. There was a lot of Lori being exasperated and groaning and putting her head in, you know, her head in her hands and things like that. But I really just wanted to know, like, what is the true emotion of, like, how does she feel about her fundraiser being derailed? How does she feel about the fellow PTA mom that blew it by hiring this dud of a impersonator? You know, I just didn't really get that actual sense of how important is this event to her. Is it more that she just wants to be the superhero to fix the situation? Is it more just like, I can't believe I'm a PTA mom fixing a Elvis impersonator situation? Like, I just didn't understand this character. And is she a fixer? Is she a wallflower? Like, I couldn't get enough of a sense of that. I liked the scene we were in. I just really wanted to know, like, what was happening here. Other than that, I think there was a lot of characters introduced in this opening scene. So one of my notes was just trying to figure out how everybody is in relation to each other. You know, we have the wives and the husbands, the PTA mom and the Elvis. Like, that's just a lot of characters to meet. So instead of maybe having this Caroline character who is the one that watches the hiring of the Elvis, like, why isn't it the two best friends? Why isn't it Eden and Lori? You know, I just didn't understand why we needed a Caroline character to make this more complicated. So, you know, I think just trying to figure out, you know, a deeper layer of emotionality of this would have hooked me a little bit more, but ultimately it's pretty interesting on scene.
Great. Thanks, Carly. Cece, what did you think of those opening pages?
I really enjoyed the opening pages. I think it's an interesting scene. I think it always makes sense to choose a scene that would make sense in your character's life. And that's also interesting and intriguing and sets us up for more drama. And I think the writer has done that here. I 100% agree with Carly's note about the need for more emotionality. You know, as an example, there's a part where Ed tells his wife, Lori, that's my girl, always the smartest one in the room. And then Eden actually agrees and says, that was fucking amazing. So what I would say to that is this. This is an example of how we need to see the emotions within the emotions. How does this make Lori feel? if her husband just turned to her and said, always the smartest one in the room, and I, you know, he actually pats her on the butt as he says this, does this make her feel irritated because she's being patronized? Or does she feel like, is she glowing with pride because her husband adores her? Knowing that matters and makes a huge difference. How she feels towards that one line, and this is just an example, there are other lines that I could be referencing, but knowing how she feels towards that one line tells me everything I need to know about the character. Tells me how happy she is in her life, tells me how happy she is in her marriage, tells me about their dynamics. And since I actually read a line that has swearing, I will also piggyback on Carly's comment and say, I learned this the hard way. A lot of readers do not enjoy swearing and they will write really mean reviews. This is not a joke, by the way. Like, please check out a book that has a lot of swearing and they will write incredibly mean reviews about how the swearing put them off. And to be fair, listen, I subscribe to HBO. I swear I'm good with it. I feel like everyone should be comfortable with swearing, but some people aren't. And that is their right. And keeping this in your story or not is also your right as the author. My quick and dirty tip is to not keep it, not have it in the first pages, because someone's going to download this on their Kindle or their iPad or whatever, and you don't want them to not buy it because it's in the sample. So this is probably me being really sneaky, but hey, I'm a Slytherin, so I get to do that. And then my second note would be to, in addition to the emotionality, would be speed it up. I did think the scene was a bit drawn out. I don't think we needed 5 pages of this. Perhaps Lori could be summoned backstage to fix the issue as opposed to being there from the start. Like maybe someone goes, we need Lori. So she walks in and then, you know, she fixes it quicker, I think. Not because it, when I say that it felt longer than it had to, I don't mean to say that the pace was dragging and I was bored, because I wasn't, I was interested. But I do think you could speed it up and or add emotionality.
Thanks, Cece. I'm a major potty mouth. Anyone who's listened to me on this podcast knows that. And anyone who's read either of my 2 books knows that as well. But the way I apply that kind of thing is very much to a specific character. So if you're just dropping F-bombs all over the place from every character's perspective, then obviously that doesn't work. But if you have one character who has, you know, a lot of rage, who has perhaps not the best filter, certainly I've been told that I say things too spontaneously before thinking about them. So if you have a character that it feels really authentic to, and they don't really have this internal filter, or they don't really care how people perceive them, and it feels truly authentic to the character, then, you know, then that's something to fight for. And I always do for my potty mouth characters. But yeah, I do. I have gotten strongly worded emails and things in the middle of the night from people who weren't so happy with my potty mouthedness. Carly?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, this is a book club targeted book. And so you would be essentially alienating some very potential fans just based on the fact of the swearing. And people and authors do get lit up on Goodreads for swearing. So, you know, Goodreads is good, it's bad. You know, you don't have to feel strongly one way or the other, but it does also influence readers. So as you know, we're on a podcast called The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. We are all pro swearing, but you will be alienating a certain group.
Yeah, so definitely something to keep in mind. And you get to decide if that's something you're going to fight for or not when the time comes with your agent and your editor down the line as well. All right, Cece, let's hear the last query letter.
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cecilia, thank you so much for this incredible opportunity to share my work with 2 amazing literary agents. I came across your podcast a few months ago and have been devouring the older episodes, absorbing the advice of writers, editors, and agents alike. I recently attended the Ripped from the Headline events hosted by Carly and her earlier How to Write a First Draft in a Month seminar. I've also very much enjoyed Cecilia and Carly's presence on Clubhouse. From these events, I've taken away many great tips and advice for my own writing. I'm sharing with you today the first 5 pages of my 80,000 word count, yet unnamed, memoir. In the blink of an eye, Allison's world is turned upside down when she hears the words, "It's what we thought, it's cancer." Now, instead of advancing her career in communications and pursuing marathon personal bests, she is left fighting for her life, her leg, and her relationship. Allison's present and past collide as she struggles to manage the mounting tension between her partner and her parents, while also navigating a whole new world of surgeries, scans, chemotherapy, and doctors. When it becomes clear to her and her specialists that she will never regain functionality of her right leg muscles. Allison must come to terms with being disabled and grapples with the impact to her self-identity, her self-worth, and her future. Unnamed Memoir is a poignant story of love, self-love, and survival. This book will appeal to fans of memoirs such as Educated by Tara Westover and Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness by Susanna Cahelan, and When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. I currently work in healthcare research, specializing in advancing accessibility standards and related public policy. While I have always loved reading and writing for pleasure, I wrote this memoir as an exercise of healing, and my hope is that readers will find some personal value in the words. Thank you again for this wonderful opportunity and for taking your time reading my work. Kind regards, Allison.
Wonderful, Cece. So what did you think of that?
Whenever I'm critiquing memoirs, I always want to start by saying thank you, extra thank you for sharing this, because it's that much more personal. In terms of constructive feedback that I could offer this writer, one, I do think you should pick a title. I know it seems like a very silly thing, but it takes me away not having a title. We're used to titles. And I do think that it's not permanent, right? Like whatever title you pick. So just pick one. I think it says a lot about how you frame the story, how you see the story. And I would encourage you to do that. Assuming this gets published, assuming you get an agent, assuming you get an editor, you won't have to stick to the title you choose. I also would say, I don't know how old Allison is when this happens. And I think that matters. So I would add her age to the second paragraph. I would commend the writer also for writing the hook part. That's the second paragraph in the third person. It works really well for memoirs to do that in the third person, even though you could use I. But when you use the third person, you're showing the agent that you can think of yourself as a protagonist, which is exactly what you have to do in a memoir. Even though it is your story, it is not your diary, it is a story. And so you are supposed to think of yourself as a main character, and you're supposed to think of your life's journey as a narrative arc that will unfold like a story. Another thing I would say is memoirs sell when there's a hook. I don't see a hook here based on the query letter. I'm not saying there isn't a hook. I'm just saying I can't see one. It's easy to conflate a massive thing that happened to you, and there was a massive thing that happened to this person, with a central conflict. And these are not the same. If your life is upended by a massive, massive occurrence, whether that's as a child, your parents got divorced in a really bad divorce, or as an adult, you became disabled. While these are important, relevant occurrences, they do not a hook make. So I would try to flesh that out. It's a difficult thing to do in a memoir. It's extra work, but it's essential. And then for the very last paragraph, I would say, I love the sentiment that you wrote this as an exercise in healing, but I wouldn't write that. Here's why. A lot of people do that. A lot of people write memoirs because they're healing. And actually, a lot of people write fiction because they're healing. And that is essential. But part of the struggle with memoirs is, why do I care about your story? This is something that editors ask, like, why do I care about this stranger's story? She's not a celebrity. So the answer can't be because the author cares. Keep that information in your vault to share it in interviews and stuff, but show the reader why they are going to want to read this. Tell your agent why readers, book club readers, and other readers are going to want to be invested in this story, as opposed to sharing why you wrote it. Specifically for memoirs, I think that's very important.
Carly, what did you think?
I also had the age note in my comments. I thought that was really important, not for the reason of ageism, but I think it matters, you know, to the reader of, you know, how old they are. So I do think that that's quite important. I think Cece was just on fire there. I think that was a brilliant, brilliant analysis. The only thing I wanted to add to that was the thing about memoirs that can be tricky is there has to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I'm not clear on kind of what the end of this story is. Again, not that you have to give away the ending, but then I want to go over to the comps here. So the comps, we have Educated, Brain on Fire, and When Breath Becomes Air. I don't know from this why Educated is a comp. Again, it's a brilliant, brilliant memoir, best-selling memoir. Also, I've talked about before the role of comps and how when the comp is bigger than the world itself, you know, that was just a ubiquitous title that was a bestseller around the world. So I feel like that's a tough comp. It's a really great book. I do feel like that's a tough comp, and I didn't really feel like that was the best comp here. And then we get to the comp of When Breath Becomes Air, which is about, it's very literary. It's about mortality. And, you know, I believe this is the memoir where the man passes away, right? And then the wife writes the conclusion. So that's it. It's again, brilliant, brilliant. I bawled my eyes out reading that book. Oh my God. Brilliant, brilliant book. And so that comp, I'm thinking about, okay, is this, how is that connected to this query letter? Is it because it's literary? Is it because we're dancing with mortality? Ultimately, this is very interesting. I grieve so much, you know, for this author and the experience that they had. And, you know, this sounds like a very, very tough time, and you've clearly been able to pull something beautiful out of it. And I think you have a lot here. I think there's a memoir here. I'm just kind of asking these pointed questions to kind of get at, you know, whether this is right for, you know, publication at this time. But my last note was just, where do you live? I didn't really get a sense of where this author lives. So I would just, you know, again, throw in a, you know, general city, province, state, region of the world. Just give us a little bit of something there. That always helps me. And one thing I didn't address was the opening paragraph, which was full of flattery, but in a very good way. I thought they balanced the entry point into, you know, why they're coming to us. And, you know, it wasn't overdone. I thought that was a very nice opening paragraph. So all in all, this has a lot of really, really great stuff in here. So thank you so much, Allison. This was really well done.
Thank you, Carly. Cece, what did you think of the actual pages?
I also have quite a few notes for her in the pages. So for the listener, we get two scenes. We get a prologue and then we get chapter one. The prologue is a scene where the protagonist is about to race. She's in that beginning part of the race where she's like stretching and she looks around and there are some people who are also stretching and shedding their extra layers. And some people are handing sweaters off to friends or family. In her case, when it comes time for her to shed her sweater, she throws it on the grass. And, you know, she talks about how she wasn't feeling great, but, you know, she wasn't too concerned about it, essentially. And it's very well written. I do want to emphasize that. But there's no tension. And I'll come back to that in a second. And then the second scene, chapter one, she's waking up from surgery, dazed and groggy. And we see Sam, who's her partner. We see what's happening in terms of what's unfolding. The nurses check on her, bring her fresh ice chips and juice and saltine crackers. Then there's a line break, different date. The writer was very careful about inserting the date at the beginning of each of these scenes. And she's in her condo, in the 18th floor of her condo on the west end of Toronto. And she's essentially grappling with what happened to her. And we listen to how she met Sam, her partner. The reason why I went through the beginning of each of these scenes is so the listener can know what we're talking about, but also because my note is a very big picture note. In terms of the prologue, like I said, very well written, no tension. In terms of the opening scene in the hospital, and I feel so bad saying this, but no tension, no conflict. It's heartbreaking, but there's no tension or conflict or imbalance. And I play this game with my clients who are writing memoirs when they're struggling with a scene and they call me and we do our whiteboard brainstorming where I say, okay, so what would we do if this were fiction? Because I think that's a great game to play with a memoir. A successful memoir reads like a novel, and a novel has a story arc with a central conflict and escalating tension and imbalance and all these compelling, juicy things. And again, I always feel weird talking about someone's life as though it were fiction, but if you want to sell your memoir, that's what you have to do. So I'm going to play this game here. If this were fiction, what would I do? So for the prologue, I'd like to see a race where she wins despite odds that indicate that she wasn't going to win. Maybe there's a rivalry. That would actually be ideal. There's a rival person there, like a runner who sometimes beats her, sometimes doesn't. And maybe she tricks him into thinking she's injured mid-race, but then she's not injured. She was just tricking him, piggybacked on his arrogance, and she won. I would love that, especially because A, it would paint a picture of her full of life before this tragic thing happened. And also because it would show her personality, like her being mischievous. For the opening scene of the hospital, there's a part where she mentions Sam and she just sort of mentions that Sam is there. What I would say is to make it a story, she would have to substitute the unfolding of events, the play-by-play. Maybe we could see her waking up confused. We don't know that she's actually in a hospital. Maybe we have no idea. We're tense. Maybe she is just woke up from a hangover. Maybe she is in a hospital. We don't know. And then little by little, the story unfolds in a manipulative way, to comment on Bianca's comment of, I think, last week's episode, where she said, you know, we are manipulators, writers, and she's right. So I would like to, maybe she could say, where is Sam, like in her head? And perhaps the nurse is checking in her, bringing ice chips, but she, all she wants is Sam. And the reader's going, wait, who is Sam? Is Sam a woman? Is Sam a man? A non-binary person? We don't know. And when the doctor saw her crying, maybe the doctor would assume that she was crying because of the pain. But because we're in her head, we know that it's not the pain only. She's crying because where is Sam? And we could feel really tense, like, who the heck is Sam? Why isn't he here? The curiosity is essential, right? Like, and please note that these are just examples. So when I play the what would I do if this were fiction game, I'm not suggesting that you make it up. You can't do that. I'm showing you how we would frame a fiction story, not so you'll use the specific plot points, but so you'll use the unfolding of the tension and the unfolding of the conflict in a way that keeps us curious. Right now, everything's happening too quickly. It's like the author has taken bullet points and written it beautifully. And there is a scene. I can tell where we are. She has done that. But it's not unfolding in a way that's seductive. What I always say is storytelling is seduction. It's about keeping us satisfied while also keeping us wanting more. And curiosity is the number one emotion you want your reader to be feeling at the end of your first pages. More than anything, they're supposed to be curious about what's going to happen. And I say this with all the love, I am not curious. I know exactly what's happening. I also want to say, I think this is normal. When you're writing a memoir, it's normal that you get all the facts out and then you weave in things, right? Like to mention what Bianca said before in that previous query, it's all about aligning, it's all puzzle pieces. So I think you can do it.
Carly, what have you got to add to that?
I think this is a really fun example of Cece and I having different opinions. And I also think this is a fun example of how difficult it is to write memoir. Everybody believes they have a story in them. And I believe everybody does. But being a storyteller is very different than being a human being, right? And so figuring out how to craft our big life moments into a story, like Cece said, that's for other people, right? Like a memoir, if you want it published commercially, you know, in a traditional setting, being sold in bookstores, it's essentially for other people, right? And it's a vulnerable thing because you are the protagonist. So I just want to emphasize how incredibly difficult it is to write memoir and how vulnerable it is, and how thankful I am to see this material, because I think that there's something happening here, right? This is a big thing. And I do think that, there's something that the general readership can't take from this. I really liked the prologue. I wrote, this is an example of a prologue I really like. And I'm normally the anti-prologue lady. So I really liked it. I did feel like we were moving fast, but, you know, because we find out on essentially page 2 or 3 that she has cancer. And so that made me think that if obviously the reveal of cancer isn't the hook, then there's a big hook coming. You know, and there could be a masterful story happening here. So I find memoir very hard to critique on a line level until I've seen the whole thing, because I need the sense of the life. Like, I need to know what are the puzzle pieces we have to move around. You know, what is the arc of the characters and the romance and the love that we have between, you know, the main character and Sam. You know, there's a love story here. You know, there's a story about our relationship to our bodies, you know, what we expect our bodies to do for us and perform for us and what happens when they let us down. You know, there's so much happening here that's incredibly interesting. But this to me is an example of something that I think is great and has potential, but seems like we're seeing it too early. Again, fine, this is, you know, a podcast, you know, we're critiquing, that's what it's for. I do feel like we're seeing this probably too early from an agent's point of view, but, you know, there's a lot here. So I would say figure out what exactly the hook is, you know, what the beginning, the middle, and the end is, and just kind of move these puzzle pieces around and figure out how to weave it into a narrative that has tension and has a plot and as character arc. This would be something that I, again, would totally normally request, but I actually represent something kind of in this space. So this would be an example of something that I'm working on that's a bit too close to a client project. So all in all, I like that Cece and I had different opinions of this one, but I definitely want to empathize with the creator on this, because memoir is tough, man. So, so tough.
You know what I don't miss at all? That vicious week before my period. So grumpy. Now it's easier to manage PMS with Estro Control. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes, night sweats, racing thoughts, low moods, poor sleep, feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of those things. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code TSNOTYAW at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code TSNOTYAW for 15% off today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th. For a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Hi, everybody. It is Carly here doing the author interview. I know you're used to Bianca doing these, but every once in a while, I like to take my turn. I also like to feature my clients when they have books coming out. I'm really, really excited about this one. I've actually talked about it a few times on the show in terms of various comps that you guys can use when you're thinking about a really, really good, richly created marriage story. So I'm so excited. Renee Carlino is here with us today. So I'm going to read her bio. Renee Carlino is a screenwriter, the best-selling author of Before We Were Strangers, Swear on This Life, Sweet Thing, After the Rain, so many more novels, and we are celebrating her new novel, This You Be Us. Renee's books have been featured in national publications like Cosmopolitan Magazine and Style, USA Today, Huffington Post, and many, many more. Her adaptation with Julia Stiles for Wish You Were Here is currently in post-production and will be available early 2025. So, so many incredible things happening for Renee and her career. So welcome to the show, Renee.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you. That was, I know, even when I myself have to talk about my backlist, I go, wow, I've written quite a few books. But yes, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk about This Used to Be Us. You know, it's been a long, much longer road than most of the other books to get this.
Absolutely. We have so much to talk about. Yeah, I even like skipped over some titles. I'm like, you know, we'll be here for hours talking about all the books that you've written. But I want to kind of take us back to the beginning and we'll get to the new novel and talk about that quite a bit as well. But I want to bring everybody back to the beginning. So you have a really interesting kind of publication journey, and most of our listeners are authors, aspiring authors. And so I think it's really interesting for us to go back to the beginning, kind of talk everybody through what your experience was like and getting published and what that journey was like for you.
Sure. Yeah. When I started writing long prose, I didn't know I would be a writer. I didn't know that I would make a living out of it, but I loved writing from the time I could write. And I was always writing something, a short story, a poem, scripts. I started in the film business. So I was reading a lot of screenplays. I taught for a while, seventh grade English, and that really brought me back to sort of the novel and the idea of the novel. And then once I had my kids, I was home with them. And during their nap time, I would just go in and write. And at some point, I have a novel, I'm not sure what to do with it. I don't know how this works. The internet existed. It was well established by that point in 2011-12. But most of the websites or blogs or things dedicated to publishing talked about querying agents. And that was really daunting. It was a really daunting idea and task. At that time, print out your manuscript for, you know, the five and then to possibly never hear about them. It just felt like a really long road. I did do a little bit of that. I workshopped the book. That was Sweet Thing. I took it to a workshop, like a local writing community. I had this wonderful workshop and I polished it as much as I could at that time. But when I decided to self-publish it, I hired a developmental editor who had been with HarperCollins. Like, I had enlisted people to help me. I knew that it wasn't where it needed to be to even be self-published in my... So I usually talk about the patience that it took for me to actually work on it a little bit, at least, to get to a place I knew it was readable. And so I did that and hired somebody to edit it, hired copy editors. At that time, I was already kind of working on establishing the marketing publicity side of it. Like, I wanted to start sending it out. Someone told me really early on, you're going to give away like 1,000 copies of your book. And I thought that was just completely insane. I was like, wait a minute, I want to charge people for my book though. Realized really early on that it was like more than 1,000. I was like easily just giving it to anybody who would be willing to read it and talk about it. If I could get that out before I wanted to put it on all of the sort of outlets. And so that's what I did. And I think I got more and more impatient, like with the idea of publishing, but I have to remind myself that I took the time the first time when I self-published that it took more than a year for me to go through those steps of editing, making sure there wasn't a ton of errors. There were still errors, but making sure there wasn't a ton of errors and getting it to a place that, you know, people could read it. And yes, that's the story. And I was very lucky because right away it gained some blog following and social media. There was a lot going on. And then, you know, I think at the third week that I had it out, it made the USA Today. And then, of course, that's when I started getting calls and, you know, that they wanted to publish it and they wanted to put it out in a more commercial way. And so I was really excited about that, but also very lucky because around that time is when it just got really flooded with a lot of material, which is great, but it's also creates a huge challenge for anybody who wants to get noticed that way, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So walk us through. So you had a publisher reach out to you. Did you have an agent reach out first or a publisher first? Or when did you decide you needed an agent?
It was this really magical, interesting time in romance because the blogger, Marisa's Book Blog, she was doing these multi-author events, Book Bash in Florida and Orlando. And at that time, the editor who I ended up working with for 8 books, she was new to Atria and was looking for authors. And she went there and I think we had already communicated at that point, but also I had an agent who was like, you're a unicorn, we're going to do this. We got this. And so I was pretty confident that that book would somehow make it to a bigger market, right? But I didn't know what the subsequent would be. So they did offer me a 3-book deal. I was really lucky with that. In retrospect, I wish I would have taken a little bit more time because I was so green and I just was in a hurry to get like, once that little bit of success, you're like, oh, I can do this, it's, you know, but it's tough. It's hard. You know, I think it'll always be, no matter what level, you're always kind of starting new again, it feels like.
Yeah, that's an interesting jumping off point. I think so many authors think it's like, if I just get the agent, or if I just get the deal, and then it's like, then it's smooth sailing. And it is like launching yourself new so many times with a new book or a new editor or a new imprint. And do you want to talk about that through kind of the mid stage of your career, what it's been like to have to kind of reinvent yourself, but just like, I don't know, come out fresh and new, you know, every time there's a new book?
Yeah, I always wanted to graduate. As I got older, I wanted to write older characters and I felt myself trying to move in that direction, but was a little bit stuck in where I sold books to. So a little stuck in contemporary new adult sort of at the time, that like early those college years where you're deciding what you want to do. And I was getting older, I already had kids, like things were changing for me. I was a bit out of touch with just current. So I felt like I wasn't maybe as accurate. But no, I felt that transition happening. And I was trying to still fit into that box. You know, I was trying to still fit into where I had sold the first book. And it became more and more difficult as the books went on. You know, and there were shifts in just as far as book deals and like who I was being published by. So when I started writing This Used to Be Us, which was really, it was the best experience. And I just want to express that to anybody who's writing, is that to write the whole book, even if you've written a ton of books and you know you can sell a book on 3 chapters or whatever, just it was so freeing to write the whole book without having a book, without having a deadline, without having, and it wasn't just about timing because I still kept myself on a deadline to a degree. It was more just that there was no, I wasn't trying to make sure I matched the synopsis that I'd written for it, which so this is 3, 6, 7, 8, 9 books later, you know, after Sweet Thing. But so this was after only writing the one full manuscript with Sweet Thing and then selling all of those subsequent books on 3 chapters and a synopsis, sometimes not even 3 chapters, synopsis and a little, you know, 1-page thing. So it was really freeing to be able to do that. I just felt no pressure at all. And it just flowed. It was so, it's not never easy, but I just, there was no, you know, expectation. So and then when I was finished with it, I felt like it was stronger than what I had written, like just prior, you know, so I don't know, sometimes it's really hard to, because you do have to love it enough to know you're never going to sell it, possibly, or no one will ever read it. And if you like the process of going in and writing that much, then it all works itself out, kind of, I guess. But I say that a lot when people are aspiring and they don't have much written. I go, you find what you really like to write then, because when you like it, you know, you won't have that big wall. Which, yeah, like I said, I know a lot of people who went to school for writing, went to NYU, have their, you know, MFA in creative writing, and just struggled to get that novel written. And it was because they were trying to write something that maybe they thought was the upper echelon, you know, as opposed to just writing maybe some stuff you kind of enjoy reading really quick, which is what I learned I can do and I like doing. So it makes it that much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's such a good point too, because there's the whole business side of writing where, you know, as you said, sometimes people can get a book deal on a synopsis or a sample, and then having to deliver the book that you set out to write versus, you know, exploring it and spending some time with it and figuring out what it wants to be. And there's no one way to kind of make it in this business, right? And we never know as a creative what project is going to connect with you and the editors and readers and so on. And speaking of readers, I mean, you are, you know, I don't want to say fortunate because that's not the right word. I mean, I feel like you've earned every single reader that you have, but you have had the joy of knowing that so many readers have experienced your work, because I think what the kind of level of saying something blew up on TikTok, but you definitely blew up on TikTok with some of your backlist books. So do you want to talk about what that was like to have a relationship with your readers and then things blow up on TikTok with your backlist and have a brand new relationship with new readers?
Yes, that was amazing. Totally unexpected. And I do work very hard and I'm really committed. And like I said, I also really like it. So it might not be as hard because I really love it. It's my favorite thing to do. It's my hobby still, you know, but it also was like this magical lining of stars too. And I know that. I know I got really lucky in a lot of ways. I wasn't putting a ton of effort into selling myself that way or putting myself on TikTok. I know there were other authors that were publishing some similar or had similar books that were very popular on TikTok. And I just kind of fell into that slot, which I feel very blessed, very extremely lucky for that. And for a book that had been out for years and hadn't done as well as some of the other books right away, had this like really slow burn. And it was really one of my favorite books to write. And so that makes me happy because I always kind of felt like it, maybe people would like it if they read it, you know? And so when that started happening, I did not expect it at all. It was different because I wasn't asking people to read it. I really feel like TikTok, you can't really, I don't know, market TikTok that well. Like it sort of has its own life. And the people that post on there have their own, you know, they don't necessarily need to be approached about it. They will find it hopefully through their own sort of, I guess, adventure. But yeah, I can't tell you how shocked I was that that happened because, like I said, I was already kind of on to the next. And it's an older book that, but I really, really love the nostalgia in that book. And I thought people would find it just wanting to kind of go back into the past just a little bit, you know, because it's not period, but I guess it kind of is, but I just feel like people could still grasp the 90s. And I loved writing 90s New York. It was romantic.
Which one took off first? Before We Were Strangers or Swear on This Life? Which one took off first?
Before We Were Strangers came out first, but definitely Before We Were Strangers on TikTok. And I think that it had that aesthetic where people could put music. Well, there's music in it. So there's a lot of music in it. You know, the protagonist is a musician. The male main character is a photographer. They have this very kind of like romantic, artsy, like organic experience being transplants in New York and just describing those things. And what I loved about New York then and now, but revisiting that feeling where there's record stores and, you know, it's not so commercial and gentrified and like a little gritty. I love that about New York still. And so yes, when that started happening on TikTok, I think that people could pull visuals easily, the subway, like music all, and then you could create little reels out of them, which were really romantic and very, you know, evocative and just so fun to watch, by the way, like one of my favorite things. And then yes, We're in This Life kind of picked up a little bit after that. But yeah, so it was still almost like, you know, we're going on 10 years of that book being out. So it was still a while that it was there just living.
Yeah. And it's like a whole new generation of readers, essentially, that gets to like experience that and the nostalgia and the reels. Yeah. I mean, or the TikToks, whatever, you know, TikTok. They were so just like emotional to watch because it's like the first love in New York City. And as you said, like the subway and the music. Anyway, if you guys want to go watch some really great TikToks and go look at them Before We Were Reels and TikToks.
People are so good at that.
Yeah. And this like, the this gets people back into, you know, your backlist and exploring other books from you. And obviously everybody is highly anticipating the next book because it's been a number. I mean, by the time this book comes out, it's coming out now. By the time this book is out, it would have been a few years before any readers have had any kind of new material from you. So I think everybody's very excited. So let's talk about To Be Us. So this is kind of your, I don't know if we want to say like grown-up novel or anything like that, but like the marriage novel. Tell everybody what it's about and the idea and what they can expect from it.
Yeah, so this used to be, it'll be almost 5 years since I've had a book out, but I really wanted to write, like I said, I wanted to write a little bit more of a mature book. I feel like there are a lot of similarities between This Used to Be Us and Before We're Strangers, even though they're at different points in their life. I think that that's the reflection, the whole idea of like reflecting and going back and kind of living in your memory and how romantic that is. And so this book, you know, it is the story that follows Danny and Alex. Danielle and Alexander have been married for 22 years. They're going through a divorce, which isn't, you know, it's a sort of a bitter divorce, but they do decide in the best interest of their kids to get a nesting apartment, which is this other apartment that they share, but they're never there at the same time. So they keep the kids in the family home, which, by the way, they really don't ever talk about this, but they really loved their family home. They both really wanted that house, and then they restored it, and they took a really old kind of beat up house and they restored it, and they put so much love into it that it created its own character for them in life. And I don't think either one of them wanted to be done with it, and they wanted to allow the kids to live there and to have a family home and to, you know, grow older and revisit it. So they got an apartment to share, you know, and then they would swap their time at the apartment and family home. So there's sort of ships passing in the night, going back and forth. But they're in these spaces and in this new space, you know, alone, but seeing what the other person is doing kind of. So I talked about a little bit about how she, I think he opens the refrigerator and sees that there's some takeout, and he then wonders, well, whose food is this? Is this her food? If, oh, that's one thing. I'll eat it, you know, but who is this? Another man's food? Like, what is going on? But also, Danielle has kept this collection of their memories on record sleeves. So music has always been really evocative and romantic. And for me, it kind of, I think that it has the strongest connection to my memories. Like, I can remember just going on trips with my parents and what they were playing at the time. And if I hear any of those songs, I'm like right back there. Smells and music, those things are really strong for me. They evoke these feelings and memories. And so she, throughout their marriage, and even when she was younger, her dad started that tradition. She would write down their memories on record sleeves. And when they're in the apartment, they have forgotten about this record collection to some degree. But when they're in the apartment, all of a sudden it's there. There isn't a lot of stuff in the apartment. Now they're just alone at different times and going to those records, playing them. And then it's bringing up all these memories of what happened, you know, what happened, how it fell apart and why they fell in love. I mean, to begin with, because I think part of it is that you forget that, you know, you were these separate people. And after a long time being together, you kind of meld. To not be complacent about keeping your own autonomy within the relationship, I think is so important. And I really love that these two people were able to see that it wasn't that they hated each other. They hated what they created as this fused entity, sort of. It is that story. You know, you do want to see people be introspective and reflect on their experience in those kind of long-term relationships. Like I said, become very complacent, and we can be a little mean, and they're both very mean to each other, extremely mean. So I wanted to see them evolve, and can people make it back?
You're the queen of this second chance love story. And this family dynamic is so interesting. The way that they kind of go through therapy in the house and like, are they going to date other people? And the memories of who they were. And as you said, this entity, like a marriage is a separate entity from them as humans, like as individual people. And when you are in a relationship with somebody for such a long time, it's like, it's very hard to kind of separate. And you make such a point of saying that so poignantly. It's a real, I know we don't want to like spoil the middle of the book, but there's also a real emotional trajectory that this book takes you on in classic Renee Carlino fashion. So do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, that emotionality and where it comes from for you? Because I don't think I've read any of your books and not bawled my eyes out. It's just like, it's something that you are very good at doing for the cathartic experience of the reader. So how do you get there? How do you just like dial it up like that?
It's so cathartic for me, first of all. No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader, right? So it is kind of like that, getting myself to that point where, and it feels a little narcissistic, I'm not going to lie. I'm crying at my own writing, you know, but it really is because it feels three-dimensional for me in it when I'm in it, like in the moment, they feel real. I know they're not, but they feel very real, and I can tap into my own emotional you know, sense and life and see how I can relate to those characters. And writing can be like the best choose your own adventure. I mean, I can decide how they make the right decision to have a good outcome or bad, or whatever it is, or wrong decisions. But I definitely cry a lot too. And I kind of let myself go there, even in an embarrassing way, like, because sometimes I'll reread stuff and go, well, that's a little too much, you know, or whatever. Like, yeah, I can rein it in a little, like, we don't need to use that device, or we don't need to, you know, our readers get it. But yeah, I think that it's important for you to connect on some level. So writers who are writing science fiction, they're writing something that feels very kind of out of touch from reality. I am like so in awe of them. Like, how did you world build this fake world? You know, but then I do think that there is that humanity, like in those stories, the really good science fiction, there's the humanity, right? And that's what that author is probably drawing from, and that, you know, making that connection. So I think it has to be there. I think you have to feel it in order to help your readers feel. You have to be there with them a little bit. So yeah, that's it.
No, it's true. It's true. I'm like, yeah, I'm very excited. We've got so many incredible NetGalley reviews, and we've heard from so many readers who are loving it and loving the emotional journey of it. So, and obviously you have great books as well. And yeah, I'm just really excited for into it and enjoy it. And the kind of like growing up of these characters together and apart in the second chapter and all of it. It's anyway, it's so beautiful. And
thank you.
The cover is gorgeous. The package is gorgeous. Yeah. And I just know everybody's going to
love it. Yeah. I am so grateful for just all the people that worked on this and like made it, elevated it that much more. It's really, you know, it starts out as an idea, but it takes a lot of people to get it to publish zone. So I'm really happy and really grateful
yes,
for that.
Yes. And your career, obviously, from doing it solo with the self-publishing to kind of building into traditional publishing. And yeah, it's a great journey. I want to switch just gears over to the film TV side of things, because you've been working on a really incredible adaptation of Wish You Were Here. So do you want to walk us through where is Wish You Were Here at? I know it has been shot and you helped kind of develop it in a certain capacity in terms of the script. So walk us through what it's like to kind of bring something of your writing to life.
Totally surreal. But also because I went to film school, I was making student films. I started in development. And I always had this idea that when I imagined all of these stories, they've always been this sort of film kind of space. Like it's very visual to me. And I always dreamed that they would, you know, make it to the screen at some point or the television screen. And so I knew how to write, you know, scripts. But when you were talking about publishing and how complicated it can be and how difficult it is even for an established, it's really difficult to get a film made. I mean, I think that it was like Steven Spielberg had a really hard time getting Lincoln made. I mean, so we're talking a very established, owns a studio, lots of things. Like, so this is, imagine the challenge of getting your, you know, the idea that you have in your mind made. I was very fortunate. Right away, I was contacted by Gabby Kona, who is producer, actress, and she's like, I love this story. I want to see it come to life. And she connected Julia Stiles, me, Molly Connors, who's a producer, is fantastic producers, produced really wonderful independent films, and just decided together that we were going to do it, like no matter what. And so went from there. It was a lot of time that everybody put into getting it to the point where now it's, as they say, in the can. It's totally shot. It hasn't been completely edited, but yeah, the goal is, I think, 2025. And going to the set and seeing actor like Kelsey Grammer playing the dad, who I couldn't, it's so surreal because I really, if you asked me to pick three people that would be the dad before this happened, I would have been like Kelsey Grammer, like just automatically. So it was very surreal to see that. Jennifer Grey plays the mom. We have some really wonderful actors playing the main characters, and I think that people will see that emotion of the story come across because they're just very good at what they do. And of course, Julia has been in the business from, you know, since she was a kid, and it was so natural for her to direct. It was like she probably second-guessed herself, but at least she didn't show it. It just seemed very deliberate, and she was so confident directing the actors, and that must have been such a treat for them to have such an experienced actor direct them, you know. So it was great. I'm excited.
Oh, I know. I was following along on social media when you were on the set, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited. Yeah, seeing something come to life in that way, it's incredible. Like you said, like, think about how hard it is to get, I mean, everybody listening, right? It's like, get an agent, to get a publisher, and then to have to go through all of that again on the TV film side in a different capacity, a different scale, but it's impossible to get art made, truly.
I know. And it's so, but everybody loves it. And that's the thing, is just, yeah, getting back to sort of the, I loved seeing this broken down way of making a film too. It was just very intimate. It was like, these were the people who wanted this, you know, they weren't just players, and they were the people that wanted to make them. So I'm extremely grateful to them, very proud. And I know I've seen a little bit, but I can't wait to see it.
Either. Is there any kind of last advice for writers that you wanted to share? I know we've kind of sprinkled in some wisdom throughout the conversation, but as a lot of aspiring authors listening, is there any words of wisdom, any parting words you want to share with everybody?
So I was talking to Hannah Sloan, another author, about, I said I wrote the book that I really wanted to. And I really believe that you sort of just bare bones and all, like, want to read. It doesn't matter if it's a guilty pleasure. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter if you're kind of embarrassed that it's a whatever. There's nothing. There's a reason why those books do well, or there's a reason why people are attached to those books, because it does something for them, you know, emotionally and, like I said, cathartically. But I think for sure to not limit yourself to just being free to write and then just writing, and writing to where you're in a zone where by the end of the writing day, however many words you write, whether it's 500 or 5,000, you get that little, like, you get the little bit of high from it, right? So before it goes out to the world, before anybody sees it, you have to really love that. And that's where you'll find momentum.
Absolutely. I love that. Well, I know, I mean, you know, I am the agent in the process, and I don't do the writing, but this is the book that I wanted to read. I love your writing, and I love how, you know, your readers are able to kind of grow up with you. Experience of writing an incredible marriage. Great read. Get your Kleenex and your shoes handy, but you'll read it in one sitting. I can't wait to get it. So This Used to Be Us, Renee Carlino's book, available this July right now. So you guys can all grab it.
Thank you so much, Carly. Thank you, everybody listening.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000 word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.